Welcome to the Times of Israel's daily briefing. Today is Tuesday, March 26, day 172 of the war with Hamas. Amanda Borshel Dan here with our editor David Horowitz and diplomatic correspondent Lazer Berman. Thank you both for joining me today.
Thank you.
Hey, Amanda.
The Hamas terror group has decided to stick to its guns and will not compromise from a total end to the war to release the hostages it has held for almost 6 months. This came after the United States abstained from blocking a United Nations Security Council resolution, which was adopted, demanding for the first time an immediate ceasefire in Gaza and a release of hostages taken on October 7th. We'll discuss this as well as internal Israeli politics when we're back.
Do you or your clients have a commercial collection matter that's going nowhere? The Sarachuk Law Firm specializes in the most challenging collection matters, whether it is a single matter or a portfolio of cases. They are based in New York with relationships around the world. Sarachuk's proprietary databases and tried and proven methods have earned them an unmatched reputation for success in getting their clients what they're owed. They work on a contingency fee basis, so they're only compensated when they succeed. The Sarachuk Law Team strongly supports Israel. You can reach the Sarachuk Team at www.sarachuklawfirm.com. That's S-A-R-A-C-H-E-K lawfirm.com. Or at 646-403-9775. The proceeding is an attorney advertisement and past results are no guarantee of future performance.
The United Nations Security Council passed a resolution yesterday demanding an immediate ceasefire between Israel and Hamas in the Gaza Strip and the immediate and unconditional release of all hostages after the United States withheld its veto and abstained from the vote. David, there have been other U.S. abstentions in resolution votes, but what is different in the text of this resolution and what it's calling for?
Well, it's a resolution that the United States is presenting as a reflection of its consistent policy that it supports a ceasefire and the release of hostages, but it's anything but. I was listening to the radio and a former Israeli diplomat was saying it's the first time that a democratic country has been ordered to ceasefire in a war by the UN Security Council. I don't know if that's true, but it's pretty staggering. It does not condition the ceasefire on the release of the hostages. In other words, the United States has joined forces with the international community in telling Israel to stop the war. Yeah, the hostages should be free as well, but you have to stop the war. It's not a permanent ceasefire. It's a ceasefire through the remainder of Ramadan, according to the wording, but with the goal of it leading to a sustainable ceasefire. And therefore, this is a really big deal. There's two points to make about it, I think. I think that this is at least in large part a reflection of the very, very poor relationship and mistrust and worse between the Biden administration and Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and parts of his coalition, but really especially Netanyahu. And it is possible that with different leadership in Israel, things might have played out differently in terms of the American stance. But it is also a decision that harms Israel. It will make it more complicated for Israel. Practically speaking, there'll be international pressure. We don't know where the Americans are going with this. I mean, they're saying contradictory things. We haven't changed our position. We have an ironclad commitment to Israel. We support Israel in its efforts to destroy Hamas. Excuse me, you've just let through a resolution that says you have to stop now. Yes, the hostages should come out, but you have to stop now. So it's pretty extraordinary, and it reflects really problematically on both sides, and it has real implications, I think, for not just for the coalition and its relations with the United States, but for Israel fighting a war in which it needs to dismantle Hamas, and that isn't done yet. And America says, yeah, you have to do that, but you have to stop fighting.
Lazer, David mentioned that this is, in a way, the United States joining the international community. I thought it was interesting to point out the resolution's co-sponsors: Algeria, Ecuador, Guyana, Japan, Malta, Mozambique, South Korea, Sierra Leone, Slovenia, and Switzerland. These aren't exactly major world powers, all of them. Why do you think that the United States is joining forces with them?
Well, again, the United States would not say it's necessarily joining forces. It certainly didn't vote for this.
But it's pretty easy for countries that really, you know, don't have a close relationship with Israel to say, okay, this seems reasonable. It does call for the release of hostages. I'm sure almost every country in the world would like to see this war end. You know, they're not facing the danger that Israel is, and they certainly more and more see images of damage in the Gaza Strip. And I think we're well beyond where the first thing that comes to mind around the world is the images of October 7th and the threat to Israel. And, you know, this is, they really have very little skin in the game. I will say at the same time that some of the countries that are supporting it would certainly like to see Hamas defeated. And that includes Arab partners that Israel has, some of which have recognized Israel and some which haven't. But we know how they act in multilateral bodies. That's true for also some European countries as well, where they use multilateral bodies to bash Israel, to push Israel. But on the bilateral relationship, it's a different story. But obviously, the most important relationship is the U.S., and that's problematic right now in and of itself around this war. But our ability to maintain at least overt support for continuing this and winning this has really been undermined. Some of it is connected to the messages coming out of Washington. When they see that the Biden administration is willing to say, you know, one thing, then obviously Europe will go a bit further and then other countries will go even further. So there's a lot of blame to go around here. I would also add that there was an act of policy decided on by the Netanyahu government, by his office, to escalate the diplomatic fight with the United States. That was around 3 weeks ago or so, and you can see that the tone has changed. And in the messages that were coming out, it says explicitly that this is a reaction to President Biden and that they're pushing back. You can have different theories about this. Some might say domestic reasons. Some might say that they've given up on the Biden administration and they're waiting perhaps for a change of government in the U.S. But there's no question that the tack that Netanyahu has taken has changed in recent weeks, and he is actively responding to the Biden administration, even when it means escalating the fight between them.
David, can you drill down a little bit into the idea that this is ostensibly non-binding?
Yeah, I don't know what to make of that. It doesn't have a clause with consequences. It doesn't specify this or that sanction if either party ignores the resolution. By definition, it's asymmetrical, I suppose, is one way of saying it. Hamas isn't a party to the UN Charter. Hamas has no intention of taking any notice whatsoever of this resolution. Israel is a party to the UN Charter. The notion that it is purely declarative. I mean, there's just weird things that the United States is saying. It doesn't matter. It's non-binding. On the other hand, we're calling for a ceasefire. It's not a change in policy. On the other hand, we're calling for a ceasefire. I mean, it is quite extraordinary. Everything that Laser said is quite extraordinary. You have to understand this. The notion that Netanyahu is deliberately escalating. But you can see that he is. He kept home the delegation that Biden had asked him to send, which was supposed to discuss how to continue the war in Rafah when Israel needs to continue the war in Rafah and when Israel needs American practical weapons support to continue the war for any length of time. American elections are not due for, I don't know, 7 months or something. The idea that you are sort of hanging tough with the government of the United States, your key ally, because in, you know, something not far off a year from now, somebody else might be in power, who, by the way, in an interview broadcast yesterday, said, you've got to finish this war and get back to what I was doing for you guys, which was trying to make peace. A former president who was pretty withering about Netanyahu at times. I mean, it's absurd. It's unthinkable. It's, you know, and it's so dangerous. We are talking, we are sitting here in Jerusalem, or near about the three of us, almost 6 months after this terrible, monstrous assault by Hamas. Laser rightly talks about the images from Gaza, but part of the reason that the world is talking about the images of Gaza is not only that they are indeed incredibly harrowing images, but the failure for people to understand, for Israel to explain, for the United States to internalize that Hamas turned Gaza into a fortress. You know, these cliched things that we keep saying, fights among the civilian population, puts the people in harm's way, has no interest in the well-being of Gazans. The fact that we keep having to say them doesn't mean that they're not true. That is exactly the case. And from very early on, bizarrely, not the military people in the United States, but the politicians and the diplomats in the United States have been saying, we think you can fight this war differently. We think you can fight this war without harming the people who Hamas is placing in harm's way. You look at the death tolls, I mean, much is made, over 32,000 dead. And when Netanyahu the other day seemed to pretty much almost confirm it, this was misrepresented in many places around the world as Netanyahu saying that Israel had killed, again, this figure that is not looked at closely, 32,000 civilians. Israel is not saying that, and nor is Hamas saying that. There doesn't seem to be much argument about the fact that something like 13,000 gunmen have been killed. Now, every civilian innocent loss of life is a tragedy, and Israel is doing its best to avoid that, again, against a government that built an army that puts the civilians in the front lines. You know, those are some of the realities. And one more reality, that October the 7th was airbrushed out of history really within days. You look back, it's not as though, oh, 4 months on or 5 months on, the world has said this is enough already. No, from almost the morning after, I'm not exaggerating by much. So the context of this, incredibly problematic. The way Netanyahu is playing it, incredibly problematic. And the same goes for the Biden administration. That's a terrible situation.
Another terrible situation is, of course, the power that Hamas holds in the hostage negotiation talks. And yesterday, Laser, you reported that Israeli officials were telling you that the chances of a hostage release deal were at best 50-50. Today, we're seeing that they're even much, much lower. So what happened last night and where do we stand now?
So the straight news here is that Hamas said last night that it is not softening its positions. It is going to stick to its demands that Israel has already called delusional, which are things that obviously Israel cannot countenance. A permanent ceasefire, withdrawal of Israeli troops, return of displaced Palestinians, and an exchange of prisoners that is well beyond even Israel's new updated willingness to release even more prisoners. Now, I think it's pretty obvious here that there's a connection to some of what we were just talking about, and Hamas's feeling that it does not need to come toward Israel at all. And it's understandable. If you look from Hamas's point of view, as time goes by, its position keeps getting stronger. It knows that it has been through the worst of the military campaign, and it's still kicking, right? So we know that the vast majority of Israeli troops who are in the Gaza Strip are now out. There's two reduced divisions in Gaza. And it doesn't see any movement toward any operation in Rafah. All it sees is the fact that there are occasional strikes and a lot of pressure on Israel, including the president of the United States, and that the operation itself is a red line, not even if civilians aren't evacuated, but even if they are, that the United States will not support that. In that situation, and you see that the resolutions in the UN are calling for exactly what you want, right? A permanent ceasefire. They called for a temporary ceasefire that leads to a permanent ceasefire, does not demand explicitly the release of hostages as a condition. Why would you not dig in, and why would you not wait for things to keep on getting better and better? That's literally what is happening. Every week that goes by, Israel's position gets worse and Hamas's gets better. The only real pressure that Israel has is that Rafah operation, but you don't see that there's any moves toward it right now. At some point, Israel has to decide that these talks are not going anywhere and that there needs to be an operation. As we're talking, there are reports I need to confirm that the negotiators that are left there are heading back to Israel. And with these demands, it does seem that a breakdown of talks at least is here, and that there's really no reason for Israel to keep negotiators there when Hamas has not moved at all and Israel has moved. So we see that not only in the relationship with the U.S. there's that crisis, but it is directly influencing the ability to get Hamas to move toward a reasonable position for a hostage release. And this is the message that Israel is going to put out. I believe that Strategic Affairs Minister Ron Dermer is going to do some interviews today with U.S. outlets. And he's going to say this message, this resolution only strengthens Hamas and makes it harder for us to get Hamas to move. And it makes it harder to get to a hostage deal. And I think we're seeing some evidence for that position right now.
David, we saw rocket barrages on cities such as Ashdod yesterday that we hadn't seen for several months. Would you agree with Laser's analysis that Hamas is emboldened right now?
It was a single barrage in Ashdod. It's the first time for more than 2 months. There were two that were intercepted and six that fell on open ground. And that was Hamas reminding people from areas where the IDF has not tackled it, as far as we're told, that it still has this capability. Militarily, I don't know that Hamas is getting stronger, but in terms of its leverage and its sway, again, you know, sorry to keep coming back to this. If I'm the United States and I keep saying, oh, you know, key imperative, get the hostages out and so on. Well, a resolution that said we support a permanent ceasefire in Gaza, conditional on Hamas releasing all the hostages and laying down its arms, Israel would be applauding. You know, Israel also would like to see the war end. The war ending requires that the people who invaded Israel on October the 7th not be able to do it again. So again, it comes back to this, you know, the disconnect between what the United States says its goals are and where it says its support lies and what it actually did in the Security Council. And for sure, it strengthens Hamas, as Laser rightly says. Why would you release anybody if, as things stand, the Americans are basically trying to stop Israel doing you any more harm, and you have no need to make any compromises?
Laser, thank you for joining us. It's a busy day for you. We'll go to a short break and say goodbye.
Thank you.
Shalom, dear listeners. This is Daniil Hartman.
And I'm Yossi Klein Halevi.
Together we host the podcast For Heaven's Sake from the Shalom Hartman Institute.
These have been some of the most challenging days for me personally, for Israel, and for the Jewish people. And one of the ways in which I've gotten through this is that I've found solace and meaning through discussions with my dear friend and study partner, Daniil Hartman.
And I hope that the Times of Israel listeners will join us as we continue to tackle the pressing questions facing the Jewish people here at For Heaven's Sake, which has become the number one Judaism podcast.
Well, Daniil, I'd also like to recommend the Identity Crisis podcast hosted by our colleague and friend Yehuda Kurtzer. It's a series of fantastic conversations with leading figures in Jewish life, thought, and culture.
You know, for decades, the Hartman Institute has been a preeminent destination for Jewish ideas and learning. Now you can access Hartman ideas on these chart-topping podcasts at shalomhartman.org/podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. We're privileged to help guide you through these challenging and even unsettling times.
And we're back. It's also a busy time for internal Israeli politics. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu backtracked on parts of his proposed Haredi enlistment law yesterday and has released an amended version following pushback from within his coalition. And today, this updated version is expected to be brought to the cabinet. In what way is it different from the initial version? And do you think it will actually be pushed through?
Yeah, I don't know if the cabinet will vote on it. I don't know if the cabinet will approve it. I think if you look at the balance of forces within the cabinet, they would approve it if that's the decision that Netanyahu wants them to take. It would then need to go through the Knesset. And so, we're probably 2-3 months, maybe slightly more than that, of any kind of potential for this to become a law. There have been multiple drafts, multiple changes. The bottom line would seem to be that in its current form, as in its previous forms, essentially it does not impose military or national service on a significantly larger proportion of the ultra-Orthodox community anytime in the foreseeable future. And for that reason, it's incredibly controversial. I think it's controversial within the coalition. It's certainly controversial within the expanded war coalition. Benny Gantz, who leads the National Unity Party, which bolstered the size of the coalition soon after October the 7th, has made clear he's opposed to it. More significantly, and I think this is potentially quite interesting, the defense minister, Yoav Gallant, who is in the United States, who is meeting with American officials, by the way, including about Rafah and weapons supplies and so on, Gallant has said he will not essentially sponsor this legislation, even though he's the defense minister, which is pretty radical, and he won't support any legislation that isn't acceptable throughout the coalition. It's not clear that Gantz will remain in the coalition if this legislation moves forward. And then it becomes very interesting to see what Gallant would do. I mean, we're getting way ahead of ourselves now, but the coalition without Gantz's party is 64 of 120, which is a relatively healthy majority by normal Israeli standards. But if you're once fired and definitely potentially maverick defense minister opposes core legislation that is central to his job and probably has no great fears of being fired again because it's happened before and, you know, what can I do? And I have to do what I think is right. And if he can, you know, bring three or four others along with him, then the coalition would be in trouble on this. The ultra-Orthodox parties are supremely interested in maintaining the widespread exemption from military and national service of their communities. I'm not sure that their entire communities support that position, but their leadership, their political leadership does. So this is trundling along and, you know, today might be an interesting milestone, but it's got a long way to run yet. There's not much, it seems to me, people talk about elections and after the war and so on. There's not much that can easily bring down that 64-strong original coalition. But this is an issue that has potential to cause, you know, real headaches for Netanyahu. He doesn't want to lose the ultra-Orthodox parties. They don't want conscription for their people. Some proportion of the coalition, especially when you've had, you know, this incredible strain on the reservists, when you have a nation that feels more strongly than ever, I think, that the burden of service is unfair, that rights and responsibilities need to be more equitably shared, certainly including among the fastest growing sector of the Israeli demographic, the ultra-Orthodox. You know, this has potential for real political consequence.
The firing that you alluded to happened actually basically a year ago today. And I thought it was interesting in the reporting that the Attorney General said that she could possibly not be able to defend the initial proposal in court. And the court date is really coming up. It's the 31st, I believe. What would happen, assuming that she can't defend it in court? What is the next stage, as far as you know?
Well, again, there are so many possibilities here. We're talking about legislation that is not finalized, an attorney general who's warning that it's potentially not legally defensible. That's her point. It is possible that the government could find somebody else to represent it in the High Court against petitions, against the legality, and against petitions that would say Israel, by law now, needs to start drafting the ultra-Orthodox. That's where, you know, things could be heading. They advance legislation. Would the Supreme Court intervene when legislation of a kind is moving and could still be amended? I mean, we've been through so many rounds of this. The court position had been, you know, you passed basically an order that gave yourselves more time to draft and pass legislation to sort this out. Are you doing that? Are you credibly doing that? Do we need to intervene at this point? You know, again, many, many potential changes here. But it is, as I say, politically, one of the few issues that you can see posing real trouble for the coalition, and legally, depending on what the court chooses to say. And you're right, it takes us back to where we were a year ago, essentially in the midst of the contention about efforts to defang and constrain the judiciary. Well, the judiciary remains strong, and it is quite likely to be at direct odds with something that the ruling majority is attempting to do.
With all of this going on, New Hope Chair Gideon Saar announced last night that his 4-seat party will depart from the coalition 2 weeks after dissolving his alliance with Benny Gantz. I just wonder, were people listening at all?
You know, I'm going to battle to be polite here. Yesterday was a very significant day in terms of Israel's relationship with its key ally, its potential capacity to continue to prosecute a necessary war that is stalled. You know, big events were afoot. If you were a fairly marginal political leader who keeps coming and going and joining and breaking up alliances, did you really think that last night was the time to hold a pompous press conference explaining your next political moves? You know, I don't think Gideon Saar is a bad person. I think he probably feels that he has Israel's interests at stake. I think he probably feels that there's a place on the political spectrum for somebody who is principled and center-right or right in his policies. But really, Mr. Saar, cancel your press conference, wait a little bit, do something more modest. I don't know. I think, apart from anything else, I think it will backfire on him. I think lots of people in Israel are saying, who is this guy and why is he on television now? Why do I need to deal with this? There's much more important stuff. It's kind of a little, and he's not even, you know, the most cynical or the worst of some of these career politicians, but that he would think that that was something that people needed to know about, I think is just one more little point that shows how out of touch the current crop of elected leadership has become from the public and the needs of the public and the interests of this nation.
David, thank you so much for your insights today.
Thanks, Amanda.
Thanks for listening to the Times of Israel's Daily Briefing. Please check out another installment tomorrow. This episode was produced by The Podwaves. If you have any questions or comments about this or any other episode, please drop us an email at podcast@timesofisrael.com. Until tomorrow, shalom.